This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The UK's digital tech scene is accelerating, and the proof is in the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. This year, we celebrate the next generation of pioneering startups that are shaping the tech landscape of tomorrow. The UK is a thriving ecosystem with access to global talent, cutting-edge research, and unparalleled investment opportunities. Your big idea belongs here. Visit great.gov.uk/UKPA to learn more.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, Donald Trump says he'll put pressure on OPEC to bring down oil prices. He says that will help end the war in Ukraine. Is he right? Also, as the 60-day ceasefire period in Lebanon comes to an end, the war between Israel and Hezbollah hasn't resumed, but are Lebanese managing to resume something like normal life? And are you a celeb at risk of getting cancelled?
You know, we're looking at things like defamatory allegations, digital misinformation about the policyholder, malicious threats against them, potentially their family or their IP.
Now there's an insurance policy to help you deal with all that. But first, during his election campaign, Donald Trump said he could end the Ukraine war in 24 hours. He entered the White House on Monday, and so far, well, it hasn't happened, but he has now set out a way he thinks the conflict could be brought to a halt. He says it's vital that OPEC, the cartel of oil-producing countries, takes action because a drop in oil prices would end the bloodshed in Ukraine. He was speaking to reporters as he arrived in North Carolina.
They're losing thousands of people a week. It's crazy. It's a crazy war, and it never would have happened if I was president. It would never have happened. This is crazy that it happened, but we want to stop it. Now, one way to stop it quickly is for OPEC to stop making so much money and to drop the price of oil, because they have it nice and high. And if you have it high, that war is not going to end so easily. So OPEC ought to get on the ball, and they ought to drop the price of oil, and that war will stop right away.
President Trump, well, perhaps unsurprisingly, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, disagrees.
Both for our and the American economies, prices that are too high are bad, because producers within the country using energy resources need to produce other goods within the country. And prices that are too low are also very bad, because they undermine the investment opportunities of energy companies. That's a matter for us to discuss.
President Putin, so would low oil prices really bring the war to an end? I asked Robin Brooks, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington.
There is a famous quote by the late Senator John McCain, who, after a visit to Crimea, after Russia annexed Crimea, came back to the United States and said that Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. That's absolutely true. Russia is a one-trick pony. It exports energy and primarily oil. So if you make the oil price go down, that materially hurts Russia. And so a production increase by OPEC would be very, very helpful. I should add that since Russia invaded Ukraine, OPEC has cut production multiple times. So if anything, OPEC has been boosting oil prices since the invasion. And so it has indirectly been helping Putin. So this would reverse that. And it's high time that that gets done.
But isn't there a complication in this, in that the countries to which Russia can export oil now at the current price are very limited, and that price often can be negotiated between the two rather than necessarily adhering to what international oil prices are?
Well, yes and no. So Russia is subject to something that the G7 and especially the United States introduced in late 2022, which is the G7 oil price cap. That puts an upper limit on the oil price that Russia can get. It exploits the fact that Russia depends on Western-owned oil tankers for a significant amount of shipment of its oil, and of course on Western services like insurance, which are predominantly based in the UK. Now, Russia has responded to this G7 oil price cap by building what's called a shadow fleet. So these are oil tankers which it holds indirectly through all kinds of obtuse shell companies. So through this shadow fleet, Russia is able to export oil to all kinds of places, and it's very difficult to police. So if OPEC raises production and pushes the oil price down, that will be very helpful.
Now, China buys a lot of Russian oil, and mm-hmm. several other countries do. Are they likely necessarily, though, to stick to the kind of prices that are out there? Because a lot of these relationships, though, based on trade, are also pretty political.
Absolutely, yeah. No, China imports Russian oil through a pipeline. That's a whole different ballgame. The global oil price, and in particular the Brent benchmark oil price, that is really about the oil that Russia exports on oil tankers. That is the vast majority of Russian oil that gets exported. So the fact that Russia exports to China through a pipeline doesn't change the vulnerability of Russia to an OPEC plus production increase.
So the line is, the price goes down, Russia can't make as much money, therefore can't afford to continue the war. That's it in a nutshell.
Ideally, two things would happen. OPEC would increase production. That would push the global Brent oil price benchmark down. That would be great. In addition, it would be incredibly helpful if more shadow fleet ships were sanctioned. The US and the UK on January 10th sanctioned 183 Russian ships. That's very significant. And that will drive a bigger wedge between the Brent global oil price and Urals, which is the crude that Russia exports. So if you do those two things, you can really do a lot of damage to Russia and its ability to wage war.
And also, of course, you've got a situation where Russia is, as we said, exporting illegally underneath the counter, as it were. And if that isn't bringing in what it needs, then that whole process, I guess, doesn't work as it has up to now.
I mean, in the end, the missed opportunity that the West had back in the early days right after the invasion was to do a total embargo of Russian energy. That would have led to an increase in global oil prices, but Russia's economy would have collapsed. The ruble, Russia's currency, would have gone into a tailspin. There would have been a devaluation crisis, a debt crisis. Russia would have had hyperinflation. It is really hard, if not impossible, to fight an invasion battle when your economy is imploding. And if we can move in that direction now, that would be great. It puts a lot of pressure on Putin.
To some extent, this is in Trump's hands, though, isn't it? Because he's talked very specifically about vastly upping the energy output of the US. That in itself would push down prices internationally. But at the same time, a lot of his key allies are in the Gulf states who don't want the price to go down that much, because they have their own problems to deal with.
Yes, and as I said right at the start of our interview, OPEC cut production multiple times in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So I do think that the Gulf states are U.S. allies. They also depend to a meaningful degree on a sort of a U.S. military umbrella of protection. And so I think Trump is right to call in some favors here and say, hey, we need to be acting together. The production cuts were the opposite of that. And so I think it's time to call a spade and have everyone act together.
Robin Brooks there of the Brookings Institution in Washington. Now, it's 60 days, 2 months, since the ceasefire came into effect in Lebanon between Israel and Hezbollah. And so far, there's no ceasefire extension, nor have Israeli forces withdrawn completely from the south of Lebanon, because Israel says the ceasefire terms have not been fully implemented. The US government has called for an urgent extension of the ceasefire. But after 2 months' relative peace, how are the Lebanese people coping? Has some semblance of normal life and business resumed there? Well, I've been talking to Hani Bossali, the president of the Syndicate of Food Importers in Lebanon. We've often spoken to him on this program, to gauge what's happening there. How does he feel things are going?
Let me tell you and tell the world how resilient and how extraordinary is the Lebanese people, because now people are afraid to come to Lebanon or afraid that there's a war. But if anybody comes to Lebanon, they wouldn't feel that there was even a war 60 days ago. Of course, I'm not talking about the demolished buildings and everything, but if you go to the streets of Lebanon, even in the areas that were hardly hit, you will see a population that is thriving and that is really full of life. I'm not saying we are in our best state, no, but I'm willing to stress on how resilient and how joyful and how strong are the Lebanese people in overcoming all the problems that we have been enduring, not only in the last 60 days, but in the last few years. If you want to start from the crisis of 2019 to the explosion of the port in 2020, to the COVID problems, to the bank problems, all over.
Yeah, when we last spoke to you, honey, we were talking about, in the middle of the war, about the problems with people leaving the south of the country, particularly coming up to the north, to Beirut, and the difficulties of getting food to people. That's obviously the area that you're very involved in. Right. Is that okay now? Are the people who've moved, the people who fled north, are they going home? And are you able to feed them?
Yes, it's not as it is pictured on the international media. Of course, there is a lot of problems. There are tens of thousands of homes that have been demolished in the south of Lebanon and in the southern suburb of Beirut. There are a lot of displaced people. But as far as normal life has come back, for the time being, we have no issues in finding the supply and the food to feed everybody. And especially that after the ceasefire and after the hostilities have disappeared, hopefully for long, but at least for a while, we have seen the regaining of the vigor and the regaining of the activity in the markets and in the import and in the production. So we can say that up till now, we are in a much better state than we used to be 60 days ago, especially due to the positive vibes that have emerged after the ceasefire. And as everybody knows, there have been a lot of political improvements from the election of a president, from the nomination of a prime minister. All this has given a push and a positive push towards a better business activity.
And what about the south? Because that was the area that was most affected. Are people returning? Is normal life beginning there as well, just south of the Litani River in that southern area?
Difficult to say, actually. You know, the most demolition and the most destruction has been done in the south of the Litani River. And you have villages that have been totally put down to rubble. So I wouldn't say that life has returned normally to these places, and especially that all over these 60 days, there haven't been a real ceasefire. There have always been some bombing and there have been some problems all over. So we cannot say that it has been a very quiet period over these 60 days. And now we are coming to the end of these 60 days. We are all monitoring what will happen on the day after. Will there be a withdrawal? I'm not seeing it happening because a withdrawal doesn't happen in 24 hours. Will there be a re-escalation of the hostilities? I hope not. We have to wait and see what will be the intentions of both parties, whether from the Israeli side or from the Hezbollah side, on how it would go. As far as the Lebanese people are concerned, I'm talking everyday Lebanese people, they want peace. They want to come back, to resume their normal lives. They want to be sure that if they rebuild their houses, it won't be demolished again in 5 or 6 years. These are very big challenges that the president and the new government, when it will be formed, will have to face. But as far as normal life is concerned, yes, wherever there is no demolition, the normal life has come back, but there are a lot of challenges. Challenges about reconstruction, who will finance the reconstruction, will there be a sustainable ceasefire so that there will not be another demolition? There are a lot of challenges on which we don't have an answer as of yet.
And that was Hani Bosali speaking to me from Beirut. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, when we talk about tackling climate change, carbon capture is a major piece of the puzzle. And within carbon capture, usually all the attention goes to trees and regenerative agriculture. But some rocks are also really good at it. The rock is called steel slag, a byproduct, in fact, of making steel. And giant piles of slag dot the US Midwest near steel mills, and they're hard to get rid of. Kaylee Wells of our US Partners Marketplace explains now just how this carbon capture with slag works and how it's putting slag to use in rural Ohio.
This patch of Northwest Ohio is a quiet, sparse grid of farms. Right in the middle of it, just 7 miles south of the Michigan border, is Delta Raceway. It claims to be the state's premier motocross track. But now, in the off-season, it's under a dusting of snow. Sean McCauley isn't here for dirt bikes anyway on this 20-degree day in January. He's here for the small rocks we're walking on. Under the snow, they've been spread out to cover the surrounding campground and pathways. And he's interested in what those rocks are doing for him.
So far, we've removed probably at least 100 tons of CO2 from the atmosphere and hope to remove over 1,000 tons by the time the process is complete.
McCauley's background is in geochemistry, and he's created his own business around these rocks. They're a man-made byproduct of steel production called slag, which, just by lying here, can capture and store carbon. That's where McCauley's company, Alkali Earth, comes in.
What we're doing is accelerating the natural processes that the earth uses to remove excess carbon dioxide with minerals.
The company is a middleman connecting the steel mills that make this slag with the places that want to use it.
So when you create steel, you can kind of think of it as like a massive soup.
Yale University's Ella Milliken studies carbon storage. She says steel gets made by dumping all the reactive ingredients in a giant pot and making it really, really hot.
The steel slag is essentially, like, you can think of it as like this fat skim on top that you pour off that's just full of all of the reactive, really good stuff that you don't want in like a steel bar.
Then all that steel slag goes into a pit to cool. The steel mill crushes it up into these little rocks, and then they sit there as inconvenient piles of byproduct, frequently destined for landfill. But Milliken says slag is great at capturing carbon. She works with Yale professor Noah Planofsky.
The steel slag has calcium in its most reactive form. That calcium is going to rapidly react with CO2 from the atmosphere, and eventually convert it to calcium carbonate.
The gravel-esque slag rocks around the racetrack are covered with an ashy brown substance. That's the calcium carbonate. That's what the carbon turns into.
The carbon is removed from the atmosphere and is irreversible on a 1,000, even a 1,000,000-year timescale.
Natural rocks capture carbon dioxide, too. Steel slag does it many times faster. And it's really cheap. Actually, Sean McCauley of Alkali Earth says steel mills will pay people to take it away. McCauley and his company also subsidize the steel slag for buyers like Delta Raceway by selling carbon credits to companies that have carbon reduction climate goals. Businesses that bought carbon credits to help pay for the slag on the Delta Raceway include Shopify, the e-commerce platform, and Stripe, the digital payment firm. So it might be cheap, but the other thing about steel slag is that it's heavy and annoying to haul.
There's over 1,200 truckloads that were delivered to the site. But the good thing is it's very close to the steel mill, and so the energy penalty wasn't that large in this case.
For now, all of Alkali Earth's projects are in the Midwest, where the steel mills are. But McCauley plans to scale up his business and thinks he won't have a problem doing it.
Right now, we're the only ones we know of working with steel slag in this way.
Now he's looking to China, India, Japan, and Australia for his next expansion.
Kaylee Wells there of Marketplace reporting on the use of slag in rock in the Midwest. Now, we're joined by Chris Lowe, Chief Economist at FHN Financial in New York. And Chris, it's a good moment, I suppose, Friday, to look back at the first working week in the Trump era and what it's meant for markets. I mean, interestingly, some of the data coming out is suggesting things aren't necessarily going very strong at the moment. We did see, of course, a big leap in the value of the S&P 500 index, but then that's calmed down a bit. And now we're getting data saying U.S. business activity is at a 9-month low in January.
Well, that's right. With the biggest weakness on the service side of the economy, that's where the things slowed down the most. Manufacturing actually improved a little bit. It's very likely that what we're seeing based on this survey and the answers from individual companies is that there was very much, particularly in some of these service industries, a wait and see. Let's see what Trump does when he actually gets into power. Remember, he wasn't inaugurated until January 20th. And I think a lot of business plans were put on hold as a result.
And was it also true with the boom we certainly saw on Wall Street in the aftermath of the inauguration itself, and now cooling down a bit? Is it people just saying, well, hang on, we know what he says, we don't actually know quite what he does yet?
I think that is true to an extent, but I wouldn't read too much into it. If you look at hiring plans, for example, in both surveys, services and manufacturing, there were big increases in the hiring indices. So I think companies are gearing up for something big. They just weren't quite ready to make the commitment last year. Also, Jamie Dimon, the CEO at JP Morgan Bank, he was speaking in Davos and this morning said he's hearing from their corporate customers that they're pretty excited about the year ahead. He expects that will translate into strong growth.
And will all this translate into a move in the Fed in terms of interest rates that is favorable, I guess, to many Americans who desperately want a cut in interest rates?
Well, on that, we have a Fed meeting next week. You'll be shocked to hear President Trump has been pressuring the Fed to continue cutting interest rates. Most economists, myself included, do not expect a cut next week, but maybe in March. We have to see better inflation news. If they are going to continue to cut, inflation must come down from the level where it was running at the end of last year.
We shall see. We shall hold you to your predictions, Chris. Chris Lowe there, Chief Economist, FHN Financial in New York. Thanks so much for being with me. Now, if we are talking about celebrities, getting cancelled is kind of a worry for them. It's what happens when a celebrity or business person says or does something that brings them negative publicity to the extent that they're effectively ostracised, fairly or not. Here are some examples of famous people trying to make amends.
First of all, I mean, my behaviour was very offensive and I apologised. There's no excuse or there's nothing to justify it. But, you know, I think that as human beings, we all say and do things that we don't mean at all.
Let me be real clear here, in sobriety, sitting here in front of you, national television, that I don't believe that Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world.
Well, there you had Mel Gibson, of course, apologizing for an anti-Semitic rant. And before that, Ariana Grande, who had to apologize for licking a donut on national TV and saying, "I hate America." This kind of thing has become such a regular problem of modern life for the rich and famous that it has a name: cancel culture. Well, now here in London, an insurance company has teamed up with a crisis communications group to offer an insurance policy for this sort of event. Samfire Risk and Barkowski PR say they're offering a 24/7 hotline for worried celebs and a 60-day plan to manage and mitigate negative coverage. Well, I've been speaking to Charlie Hanbury, Samfire's CEO. How does this policy work?
What the insurance policies we typically provide as an organisation, I would describe in the simplest terms, as acting as connective tissue between usually a very complex problem and an organisation that can provide help, resource and expertise at that moment of need to help the policyholder address that complex problem. Specific to this case, we're looking at kind of crises around reputation, some of which could also have malicious intent. You know, we're looking at things like defamatory allegations, digital misinformation about the policyholder, malicious threats against them, potentially their family or their IP, social engineering, bribery demands, things like that, really.
You said a couple of words. You said malicious, you said pile on or this kind of thing in a social media context. But I mean, I suppose people think, well, someone caught in this situation probably has said or done something that they shouldn't have done or that people take a very dim view of. And that's the starting point, isn't it?
Yeah. And obviously, you know, without getting into the granularity of an insurance policy, the terms and conditions do address the circumstances where somebody has completely brought it upon themselves, or they've committed a criminal act at the most extreme example. But, you know, I suppose if I was going to draw a parallel, you know, an insurer will not provide insurance to somebody who owns a house if that house is already on fire or if they set fire to themselves. But what an insurer will do is obviously insure a person's property against accidental or malicious arson, and also provide them with tips and assistance in how to better risk manage their property. So that might be in the case of fire, you know, sprinkler systems, extinguishers. There's no real difference here. You know, we're not metaphorically looking to insure people who've set their own house on fire or already have, or whose house is already on fire. But the insurance will also provide, as well as the access to the expert services of our partners, public relations, as well as access to their services, it will provide training, risk management tips and tricks as to how to better manage reputation, how to ensure that in, you know, if you are in the public domain, you are not accidentally treading on any potential metaphorical landmines.
Okay, so, Charlie, let me just pick up on that, because you used that analogy of a fire. I suppose if someone, you know, says something that they shouldn't, they are in a sense perhaps setting a flame to the house in that sense. Would they still come under the insurance? Would the insurance say, well, look, if this happens, we will attempt to help you anyway?
Absolutely. You know, again, you know, insurance is there to pick up accidents. You know, people have motor accidents, they don't intend to crash their car. It's an accident. So, you know, the policy caters for that kind of accidental step into potentially damaging a reputation through an unintentional act.
Right. And then I suppose if I come along as a celebrity and say, well, look, I fear that this might happen, I might take out your insurance policy. What you'll let me have is, first of all, as you mentioned, perhaps a bit of training of ways of avoiding the problem in the first place. But if the worst happens, essentially the policy delivers a service of advice. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. So what it's really doing is it's removing uncertainty at moment of need, who to contact and how to contact them.
Now, Charlie, you're a businessman. I mean, you'll look at this. If someone comes along, and I'm not going to name any names, obviously, but if someone who perhaps is more likely to do this and perhaps do it in a more damaging way, they would end up paying, I don't know, higher premiums than someone who perhaps is very unlikely actually to get into this position.
Yeah, I mean, we have an underwriting methodology, and we have an actuarial approach as to how we're going to assess the risk, and profiles of organisations or individuals who wish to buy the policy are obviously part of that. So, yes, just like any insurance, you know, it will be assessed on the likelihood of loss being higher or lower, depending on who the policyholder is.
It's funny that such a thing needs to exist, because, I mean, if we'd been talking like this 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't have seen a need or a niche in the market, I suppose.
No, I think that's probably fair, but you know, I think across some of the other insurances we write, which, you know, maybe, you know, emergency medical situations overseas, acts of terrorism, we're involved in kind of extortive crime insurance. You know, going back to my original point, these are all very complex problems that have always been addressed by people who've suffered them in whatever means they can do at that moment of crisis. All insurance is doing is providing that connective tissue to experts that can help, and potentially shortening that period of time between the crisis occurring and the individual or the organisation getting help. And insurance has evolved in that sense over the last 2-3 decades across a whole myriad of complex problems. Reputational issues is just perhaps the latest in a long line of those.
Charlie Hambury there of Samfa, which is setting up a policy for celebs who fear they might get cancelled. That's it from World Business Report.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.